5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Model Moon!
The dark side of the Hoddle Moon. Immutably amazing crypto wisdom. On today's episode, we talk to Jesse Phillips about all things crypto mining. Stay tuned to find out how you can join the dark side of the Hoddle Moon mining pool and claim your block rewards. You are now orbiting the dark side of the Hoddle Moon.
Copy. This show is proudly sponsored by Salamantech's point-of-sale devices and software. Tired of all the headaches dealing with cryptocurrency? You don't know what a private key is? You don't want to deal with exchanges? Well, if you're a business and you just want to run your business without thinking about cryptocurrency headaches, look no further than Salamantech. We provide point-of-sale software that allows you to get paid in fiat currency, that's euros, allowing your customers to pay in cryptocurrency, that's BTC, ETH, and a host of others.
Stand by. Dark Side of the Hoddle Moon proudly uses the audio services of Eye the Sound. Beyond the amazing sound production, they've really been a sounding board, pun intended, for our show, giving us great customer support and constructive criticism and feedback. So if you want a little bit more personalized attention you're not going to get from a bigger provider, check out iThesound.com.
Hoddle Moon!
All right, and we're back with another episode of Dark Side of the Hoddle Moon. I'm Block 8. I'm here with Josh again today. Josh, how are you doing?
I'm all right, thanks. Let's get into this new episode. I'm excited to talk to this guest and find out a lot about the new topic, which today is going to be crypto mining.
Yeah. So I met this gentleman in the New England crypto space. I've seen him give a couple speeches. He knows his crypto mining. And with no further ado, let's announce him. From Harpia Mining, it's Jesse Phillips. Jesse, how are you doing today?
Great. Thank you so much for having me here. It's a pleasure to be on.
Yeah, we're excited too. We're kind of interested in crypto mining. None of us really mine ourselves, except if you count Honey Miner running on the GPU, you know, cranking out a couple pennies every month. But other than that, I don't think Josh or myself consider ourselves crypto miners. But let's start from the beginning, just to kind of rewind it a little bit. So when and how did you first get into crypto?
All right. This is an interesting story. So I think my like origin story is very similar to a lot of people that are kind of interested in alternative lifestyles and crypto in general. A lot of people that I know got into crypto, or at least were exposed to, I would say, Bitcoin at first through the Silk Road. And so my first foray into it, I wasn't the one that purchased the Bitcoin. But to be perfectly honest with you guys, it was for things that I probably shouldn't talk about on air right now. And this was in high school for me. And so I had heard about it. And I remember speaking to my father in probably 2010, the first time I ever heard about it. And that was on a Steam game. So I used to play a lot of computer games. That particular game was Day of Defeat Source, so similar to Counter-Strike. And someone had offered me a bunch of Bitcoin for my Steam account. And so I looked into it a little bit, didn't realize, you know, kind of like what it could be. I think the number was like 50 Bitcoin or something for my Steam account at that time. And I said no to the person, even though they were on my friends list. And then fast forward a couple of years, I'm talking to a couple of friends and they're like, hey, have you heard about this thing called the Silk Road where it's like Amazon for everything that you can't buy on Amazon? And I'm like, let's check it out. So I downloaded Tor browser, figured out my way on there, and then had one of our friends, mutual friends who had already kind of understood buying Bitcoin, basically buy the Bitcoin and get it. I will say this, it is legal now in Massachusetts. It was not then. So that was the first foray into it. That's how I kind of got into it. Fast forward a little bit. I kind of, you know, don't really look at it for a couple of years. And at the end of college, one of my friends who actually works still in blockchain Bitcoin stuff basically comes up to me and says, based on your thesis and kind of what I'm interested in, I think you're really going to find this interesting. I had done reports on the Silk Road because I was always fascinated with it, you know, for public speaking my freshman year and all. But he introduced me, and that was when I bought my first ETH and Bitcoin. And at that time, I think I bought my first Ethereum for around $55 and Bitcoin for under $1,000, I remember. And basically just started trading from there and got really, really into it that summer. So that was 2017. So a little bit of 2010, 2013, 2017, it's been gradual.
Yeah, that's cool. I kind of came about it through like reading like libertarian blogs and that way. It sounds like you came at it a little bit from the gaming or the tech side. That's and also through Silk Road, I guess.
Yeah, I remember distinctly also always being kind of interested in alternative forms of monetization and cryptocurrency, like that kind of thing. I didn't really understand what it was for the world. But I remember distinctly being in school in college when Mt. Gox got hacked. So when they shut down in 2014 and thinking to myself, maybe I should buy Bitcoin for $1 when it crashed. But I just didn't like, you know, I was busy with my own stuff and I just kind of, you know, kind of passed that opportunity up. I do remember at the very end of college, though, just through looking through, I'm pretty active on Reddit, looking through that, I saw. I was asking on Bitcoin mining forum or on the Reddit subreddit, what ASIC I should use to mine in my dorm room, the end of senior year. So I've always been interested in a little, but you know, yeah.
Nice. So you kind of heard about it. You didn't want to give up your gaming account for 50 Bitcoins. And then a few years later, you're back into it. So, and then you kind of went full steam ahead with it, it sounds like. And, was it for the money? Was it for the politics? Was it for the tech? Was it for a combination of all three? Like, what kept you into it?
Yeah. You know, it's something that I also like kind of wonder too. I think it was the idea that you could participate in something much larger than yourself. And also fundamentally, I was fascinated. I've worked a little bit in VC as well. I spent a long time in Silicon Valley. In terms of basically my past, I attended Draper University the first year through that. And so got very interested in entrepreneurship and that whole realm. And I was really interested in fundraising techniques. And actually when I graduated school, I was working for a place called the IEC. And it stands for International Entrepreneurship Center. And they had a company come through there that was basically trialing out an ICO raise. And so I was already interested in what Bitcoin and this whole blockchain thing was, had already kind of bought into Ethereum and was making money trading it. And so I got brought on as kind of, you know, the crypto expert for them. In hindsight, it was kind of crazy that they trusted me with that. I wrote the white paper, co-wrote it, but, really did most of the grunt work on that one. And so, I was really, I really think that it was the idea of an alternative fundraising technique. So the ICO thing really fascinated me. I was like, here's a way that entrepreneurs that don't have kind of that can be from anywhere, not just Silicon Valley, can get started and raise for really cool projects that are also kind of decentralized. And, you know, I thought that was really interesting and hopped right into that. So
cool. So you kind of came into it from the business, tech, finance, fundraising, VC kind of, route, I guess.
Yeah. I was always interested in Kickstarter and crowdfunding, but thought it had some limitations. And now I was like, oh, ICO, this is awesome. You know, people are raising absurd amounts of money. This is the type of money where you can really, you know, build a team out, get started, actually, you know, do something. And you're not giving up equity, which is traditionally how a lot of the, you know, seed and series A rounds go, where you give up massive amounts of equity. So I was like, this is a home run if you can pull it off. And yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome. And can you tell me what company it was or?
So the company is called 18 Moons. It's still in existence as far as I know. It was a dual-sided kids platform. So it's a double-sided marketplace. So it was for content creation. And actually, I think the idea for it was really well ahead of its time. What it was essentially doing is democratizing the content creation side of that YouTube had kind of failed to do, meaning that, you know, YouTube in general is a great place to publish content, but the way the algorithms work and the way that people get big on there is not very conducive to new content creators, and especially for niche things like kids stuff. And at the same time, you had problems where you can get to the weird side of the internet very, very quickly on YouTube. And so a lot of the filters for kids, like YouTube Kids, don't really work that well. So this was a way to basically call for content or crowdsource content, and people would be paid out in these things called Planet Kids coins, or PKK. And that was for the content creators. And on the other side, they would pay a small bit of that basically to submit. So, because if you have like a little barrier to entry, it wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't get all the kind of like useless crap, so to speak. So we designed that. We actually, this is crazy. We got picked up on Bloomberg Radio. We made the front page of the Boston Sunday Globe, on the business section. And I think it was a $10 million raise. So we're trying to set something relatively low compared to a lot of the stuff like Filecoin that was raising, you know, in the 200 million range, I believe. This was at its core a utility token. And it was a really interesting project, very interesting to design, like token economics. And so this is, and we had, you know, Samsung Kids was out of South Korea, I believe, was kind of basically pairing up. So we had all the makings of something where I think we really could have actually been successful. And about a week before our raise, I believe it was March 2018, William Francis Galvin basically, or I guess one of the junior guys from the SEC, basically bring the ban hammer down and just basically to everyone that was doing ICOs in Massachusetts at the time, they sent a basically kind of like a cease and desist type thing. And we weren't able to they said, you know, you're not able to talk to your community or like update your website for 3 months. And finally, wow. They said, hey, you know, it actually does not qualify as a securities, and it actually is a utility token. And we were like, yep, knew it. But by that time, it was way too late. You know, we had lost the community and the ICO was dissolved. So.
Yeah, that's a bummer. I mean, me and Josh have talked a lot about that on the channel about doing crypto in the U.S. And was it a federal issue or was it a state issue? Because a lot of people are going to Wyoming and a few other states that are more crypto friendly. Was it the state that was cracking down on you?
Yeah, it was Massachusetts. Okay. And yeah, I've actually had talks with people. Wyoming is super progressive in that sense. So. I've had talks with people from Wyoming about the ICO space and just kind of alternative fundraising and all that. So
yeah, well, you've got to be asking yourself at least two what if questions. What if I bought Bitcoin at $1, and what if we were allowed to go through with that company? That could have been pretty lucrative and pretty game changing, huh?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of stuff left over from 2017 that has, you know, in due course died off. And I think that's kind of for the better. There's a lot of, I mean, I would say crap projects, or as some people call them, shit coins, that came around during that. My favorite actually is, I believe it was Alpaca Fur that was tokenized. And that was like a real ICO. So it was, you know, kind of just one of those Wild West moments. I've heard so many stories of people. I know people personally that mined a ton of Ethereum back in the day and, you know, then it got lost on an exchange when the exchange was, you know, was taken over, or people that had a bunch of stuff in the wallet. So I try not to go over like the what ifs, because knowing myself and kind of just in general, I think most people that like HODL throughout, like did so unwillingly or unwittingly, meaning like they just forgot the key. And then 10 years later, they're like, oh my God, I have that. But yeah, to really hold on, like I guarantee you, I would have been, you know, in college or something and been like, yeah, I could totally buy a new computer or, you know, or treat my friends to dinner or something and sold the Bitcoin for like $50.
Yeah.
So I try not to think about like what if like that, but it's always, you know, kind of in the back of your head, like what if we actually completed this raise, where would my life be now?
Yeah. The last interview, Coach K, his friend in college, he made a ton mining Bitcoin at the time, and he bought like a BMW and a bunch of weed. He lived in Canada. It was maybe $50,000 at the time, but if he would have held it, if he would have hodled it, he'd be a multimillionaire. But yeah, it's always one of those what if questions. Well, that's maybe a good transition to actually get into what we're talking about today, crypto mining. So we found out how you got into crypto, and this, I guess, 18 moons, it sounded pretty interesting, but the U.S. ban hammer came cracking down. So how did you go from that to getting into crypto mining?
So fundamentally, I wanted to work in crypto, and I had kind of in the beginning of my career, I guess, keep in mind, this is pretty close to coming out of school. I had kind of received probably the biggest kick in the teeth because
what year did you graduate? Give us some context.
2017.
Okay.
2017. Yeah. So it's relatively recently in the grand scheme of things. The ICO basically fails for the reasons I told you about. That's a huge kick in the teeth because I'm working on the, to be perfectly candid with you, I'm working on the prospect of like a success-based thing. So I've always been entrepreneurial, and so I just kind of was like, hey, I think this will work. If I put some time into this, you know, this could be something. And I really think it could have, had the regulatory environment not changed that way. But so I'm sitting there and I'm like, there's got to be a more secure and there's nothing ever risk-free, but I will use the term now, risk-free way to invest in crypto. And so actually, interesting enough, a lot of the carryover from that company, 18 Moons, came into our current company. And so my boss's son basically walks in to the IEC at that time the next day or maybe 2 days after and has the rough beginnings of what later becomes kind of the Harpia model. And that's kind of what we base all of our projections off of. At that time, it was super rough. And it had a name which I won't bring out on air because it's rather embarrassing, but it's kind of one of those things where you can like totally think about like everyone's in the ICO mindset and then they come up with some crazy name for it. And I said basically, all right, you know what? I'm going to do 40 hours a month, so essentially one day a week, I'm going to work on this project because I think it's interesting. At the time, this is actually kind of a funny story and keeps on coming back. At the time, I was dating my college girlfriend, now ex-girlfriend, who lived in Buffalo. So I was very familiar with Buffalo there and was looking for a way to actually move to be with her. She would graduate basically the next year after that. So I was like, I have a year to basically do something where I can make enough money to move. And I looked at it and I'm putting all these things together and I'm like, crypto mining might actually be a passive income source so that I can actually, you know, kind of do another job there and I'm not tied to just kind of slinging drinks or something in Buffalo. And I was actually at her house one day and her brother had, you know, we talk about like Honey Miner as if it's not like really so much crypto mining, but her brother had a gaming computer upstairs with a 980 Ti. It's an NVIDIA card. And I told him, I said, you know, there's a program called NiceHash where you can download it and like 15 minutes later, you'll be mining crypto. And so he downloads it, turns it on. At that time, it was making like, oh my God, I think it was like $450 a day, something crazy like that. It was the first time I saw that with him. It was crazy. I was like, just so I'm clear, like, what are you paying for electricity? Cause this matters. And he's like, I think it's like 5 cents. And my jaw like pretty much hit the floor there. Cause I'm sitting there like, oh my God, I figured it out. Like I can just move here, you know, run a couple of miners in a warehouse somewhere in the back of someone's warehouse and literally have enough to afford rent there. It's just not that crazy. I mean, you can be on the main street, like Allen Street, $1,000 a month or something. It's not like Boston. So I'm sitting there like my brain's just, you know, going and I'm like, this is going to be my future. Keep in mind, we also have this model that we've been working on. And so the original idea and our first trip as a company, we went to Buffalo to basically and met with a bunch of realtors who my ex's dad actually helped us out with that, to go find basically the back of some warehouse with enough power to go mine some crypto. We had an investor lined up at the time and that was really kind of just the the very beginnings of Harpia, who we had no idea what this would turn into. So that's really the beginning, I guess. Summarizing, it's just like wanting to participate, but wanting something a little bit less risky than like betting it all on token, going out, trying to raise money. Wanted something that you could predictably monetize, and kind of like things fell into place where we were like, Buffalo and Western New York in general is like a really great hotspot for it, and still is actually. And so kind of all that together allowed me to basically say, look, I'm going to take a chance. And, I joined as basically COO. And for, I guess the first probably 8-9 months at that time, it was just myself and my co-founder, Pedro. So that was the beginning of Harpia.
So did you build out, a little mining operation in Buffalo, and was that like a Harpia operation? Was that like your own little side project or?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'll get into it as best as possible. We made, as most startups do, a lot of mistakes in the beginning. And for one, we raised money for a family and friends round, and we started off and basically said, look, we can't necessarily raise enough to do this, but, we were going out and kind of hitting up the friends and family, like the networks that we've had already, and saying like, look, we need X amount to start it. And just to give you like an idea, it's like, you know, $500,000. We were basically saying, you know, we'll cover like $2,000 a month rent. We'll go pull the power from somewhere. We kind of met the people that we needed to get the power there, and knew like, you know, like we were quite literally going to go to Buffalo, and, you know, half the time be marketing and working on the model, and half the time basically in like in sweats and a t-shirt, putting up computers on racks. So it was like, it was really like very hands-on. We ended up basically getting in bed with an investor who later had legal trouble in the United States, left us holding the bag. So that was the first of many, like, you know, like, oh God moments. And you know, yeah. those are the types of things that sink companies. So no, we actually never, you know, we ran a test bench in Massachusetts, with a bunch of graphics cards, because at that time they were still making money. But this was, no, it never got off the ground in the first little bit in Buffalo.
Live and learn. You definitely left you hodling the bag, if I could say so.
Oh, yes, absolutely. All right. I won't mention names, but he was an interesting guy. So,
just to interject here, and maybe some of the audience might not know some of the terms, so maybe we could do like a little bit of a mining basics in terms of terminology. So,
sure.
Could you explain some of the terminology that is familiar to you, such as CPU, GPU, ASIC, distance, and things of that nature? Because I'm sure that lots of people are interested, but they don't know what, you know, it's like a foreign language to them. So maybe you could explain, you know.
Yeah, I'll go over kind of like a timeline in a way to help explain it. 2009, Bitcoin comes out, or at least the white paper is released by Satoshi Nakamoto. And at that time, it's this idea of one CPU for one, like one vote, basically. And that stands for a central processing unit. It's, you know, when we look at modern ones, it's the Ryzen 3900X is like a flagship, or Intel, their i7, i9 line. Really, if you think about it, it's very good at doing a lot of the things in like basically everything that your computer does that's not specific to like a GPU or something. It ties everything together. Is the best way I understand it. GPUs are graphics processing units. That kind of came next in terms of what people were utilizing to mine, and essentially people realized that, you know, these things that can pump out millions of pixels you know, a second are also very good at doing a bunch of very small calculations for mining purposes. And so, you know, you transition from basically CPUs. And there's a huge jump from then to GPUs. Then the first ASICs come out, which are application-specific integrated circuits. And those are essentially things where you, like, you can't run Microsoft Word on it. CPU, you know, you plug it into your motherboard, you can run pretty much any program under the sun. ASICs are specific to their one particular task. So a good, like, the kind of the ASIC that everyone knows is the Bitmain Antminer S9. Which kind of sits as kind of the current like everyone has it, miner out there. And then FPGAs are kind of another kind of whole thing, field programmable gate arrays, which are, you can kind of think of it as an ASIC mixed with a GPU. ASICs are hardwired in one to do one particular thing. FPGAs basically act as an ASIC once they're programmed, but you're kind of like switching the internal wiring using software, so to speak. Nice. GPUs also can be done, be utilized for many different algorithms, whereas ASICs are only one algorithm.
Yeah, I have a question too. I'm kind of a crypto mining newbie. And when I think of mining, I think of how it relates to, you know, mining diamonds or mining gold. So how deep do you have to go to mine crypto?
Oh, man. It's a rabbit hole. You go down the rabbit hole and you're like, you know, there's always something new to learn. So you got to go real deep, and or you can go on the surface. You can buy something right now online from China, have it shipped to your door and plug it in, and you can set it up. It's pretty simple, kind of like a router, right? But then when you start getting real deep, you're like, oh, how do I, manage 1,000 of these things? What does the power look like? Who do I have to contact? So it's endless, man. In terms of similarities to regular mining, I would say a lot of the same scale is actually being deployed, meaning like the resources and power that people use to actually like mine for gold or diamonds, like that kind of size of and scale of money going into it is now going into crypto mining, which I think is more, kind of like the closest similarity, I guess.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts on like the mining pools? So obviously you've got like F2 pool. I've heard of them because they actually backed one of the projects that I worked on. And what do you think about mining pools in general?
It's a mixed bag because obviously we have to work with them. But at the same time, you look at these things and you're saying you're pooling hash rate together. I'm going to try to tread lightly here. I'm not completely against centralization of resources because I think that there's just most things in the world are actually better centralized, even though I'm pretty interested in decentralization of almost everything. But I think functionally, centralization is not a problem. I do think, though, that when mining pools have a ton of hash rate and have the power to kind of use that in a not so good way, that's when you run into problems. And so without naming names, there are mining pools where they're approaching basically 51% attacks if they were to use or were to point the power in that sense. And that just means essentially you can go in and alter things on the blockchain. So to me, we need them. Also, it's a great way for people that are trying to participate in mining, but are more on the programming side to also, making these pools is also very lucrative. But like there's problems, like for example, with NiceHash, especially with GPUs more so than ASICs, where people would essentially rent out or buy a lot of mining power and then point that all at something like, for example, like Verge was hacked in that way, where they did a 51% attack where, they essentially altered things on the blockchain. So I'm in a mixed bag. Fundamentally though, there's some people that have very interesting ideas on how to democratize and decentralize a little more of the pool structure as well.
Yeah. Well, I think
that's not me.
Yeah. I think right now, like unless you're gigantic, a mining pool is, you have to be in a mining pool. It's almost a necessity. But that kind of, yes. you mentioned cloud mining. So can you give me your thoughts on cloud mining? So you're renting hash power versus actually purchasing the hardware.
Yeah. So, I mean, with a pool, right? Look, they are necessary 100%. Especially because solo mining is at this point a $1 billion+ proposition, which basically means you're just, instead of donating all your hash rate to and being paid proportionally to the amount of computational work you do, which is kind of pool mining, you're basically putting all, you have enough computational power to go and basically try to solve the block, which means you get the entire block reward. At this point, it's 12.5 Bitcoins, roughly every 10 minutes. Cloud mining presents, first off, to my knowledge, not legal in the United States yet. But cloud mining presents really difficult challenges because of transparency. And so, to be perfectly frank with you, my dream is to have something along the lines of cloud mining, but to have people actually own the infrastructure under it and be very transparent about what that infrastructure is. But for example, let's say I'm a mining manufacturer, and I create a chip that, and this has been done, by the way. For example, I will name this, like Bitmain used to and probably still do mine with their chips before they send them to people. Well, so, you know, let's say you have, say, the S9 that comes out and they're being used. So they're more efficient at that time, say 2016, than anything else. And they're being used by that manufacturer. Well, if you have a cloud mining contract with that manufacturer or with someone that's running those, they can basically say, hey, we're running an S7, which is, you know, loads less powerful, actually be running a different ASIC, or in the terms of like today, basically a secret ASIC, and be not very transparent about what you're actually running. And since you only own the hash power coming out of it and not the infrastructure or the chip itself, it's not transparent enough for me to inspire confidence for me. I don't technically, like, I wouldn't say that's something that really interests me, because I think that the real upside of mining is also owning a bit of infrastructure as well, and having kind of like a cash flowing asset that you have, not just owning a certain amount of hash power, basically because you are open to more asset price valuation fluctuations and how that really hurts you, right? I think it's better actually just to buy the coin at that time. So that's kind of my thoughts on cloud mining. It's also a really, really small and niche industry right now, but kind of like ETFs, I think once they do it right, it's going to be very big.
Yeah. I would say, like, I kind of agree with you, but I would say devil's advocate. I would say, like, one argument is like, well, if you do the cloud mining and you just do a short-term contract, you're not holding the bag if you have a bunch of worthless ASICs or, you know, out-of-date ASICs, or you've got a bunch of hardware you can't make money with anymore. I guess that would be Absolutely. The only upside. It's kind of an insurance policy versus going all in YOLO style.
Yeah, I part of our investment thesis is hardware swaps, in terms of like basically transitioning out older miners to places where they can be run, transitioning in new miners, etc. And so I am probably very biased in terms of understanding how that monetization works on the other side. And so to me, the idea of running something but not owning it is not that interesting. That being said, I 100% agree. For some people, they just want to buy a contract on hash power, and that works for them. So I think there's a huge market for it. I would like to see it implemented in a better way. And fundamentally, just knowing the numbers on our side, the contracts that I've seen are grossly overpriced. So that's just, you know, kind of my opinion. But, you know, to each their own. It is definitely part of the mining scene.
Yeah, well, it seems, I just had another question. Maybe if you're interested in getting into mining, it seemed like you really went from, you know, having your ex's brother's NVIDIA card, just mining with that, and you just went to like full-on warehouse mining. But I think a lot of people who start, they start with like, I think these days, in the last couple of years, they start with two GPU graphics card, two NVIDIA cards, or like a 4-card rig, 6-card rig, 8-card rig. Yeah. Sometimes they do like 2 8-card rigs. They've got a whole wall of GPU miners. I know people on YouTube, just out of curiosity, I've been following a little bit, Voscoin, Red Panda Mining. So what are your thoughts?
Both great.
Yeah. So what are your thoughts about mining at home? Do you think it can be profitable? Do you think it's just interesting, a fun thing to do? Would you recommend newbies try that? You know, maybe they could try and mine, and if it doesn't work, they can still sell their graphics cards. They're popular on the secondary market for people who play video games. Like, what are your thoughts on like home-based GPU mining?
Yeah, look, I am super in favor of it. I might be biased because to be fair. I think a lot of people that work in an office space can also run them profitably, only because, you know, their computer there is probably not getting metered, so to speak. Honestly, personally, and I just find this fun, I actually still run GPUs. So our original test bench that we made in a server case, we still run that just for fun. I still run, oh my God. I like to build PCs for a hobby. So I probably still run 3 or 4 graphics cards at any given time. Most of them are RX 580s. I've had NVIDIA cards. I've played around with all of them. And I think for someone getting into it, especially if you're a gamer, I've always said that, you know, as long as you kind of just do the math out, it is a way to subsidize your gaming hardware, which I find really interesting. And you do learn a lot. You know, there's not really a big barrier to entry, especially with GPU cards. So I'm highly in favor of it. I know NiceHash is kind of like all but shut down, but that's a really open starting point for a lot of people. And there's other things like HiveOS and stuff like that. So I'm super in favor of it. I think profitability wise, we're going through kind of the last generation of home miners where they're not going for very speculative coins, meaning something where it's stable enough to just say, like, I have a idea of how much I'm going to make over X amount of time. Because there's always, I think, going to be low cap coins that you can allot your GPU power to and say, I'm hoping that this thing also goes up 50% on a trading desk or on an exchange. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to cash out basically in time to market. That's, I think, always going to be a thing in terms of proof of work. But in terms of, like, I really think that even if you look at like something like a GTX 1080 Ti, which was kind of the king for a while, it's an NVIDIA card, versus like the newer RTX models, they're just priced for performance. I think that ship has sailed quite a bit.
Yeah. So just to translate that real quick, he's basically saying that you might even be mining at a loss, but if you think the coins are going to 10x or go up in value, it's still worth it to mine it because you're speculating that the coins are going to go up in value. Even if you're spending $300 worth of electricity to get $200 worth of coin, if you think it's going to go up, it's still worth it to mine it versus to buy it. But yeah, that's pretty interesting. Yeah, there's all kinds of interesting things. I honestly thought about buying this USB ASIC stick miner just for fun. I don't think it's very profitable, but it'd just be kind of cool to have one, I think.
So I actually love that idea. There's a whole community of people that actually, I guess, I don't know the exact term, but I think it's called like lottery mining, which is essentially using something really like, they're called block eruptors, those little USBs. Actually, people used to like plug in like 100 of them. So on Alibaba, you can still find like 100 USB like power splitters that plug into the wall. It's funny, but you can mine with those, and just setting it up will be an awesome introduction into this world. And one of the things people do is basically say, like, all right, it's like a one in a billion chance that I'm going to find, or that I'm going to basically solo mine an entire block by myself. It's not impossible. So, but like, if you think about it, and you know, Bitcoin at say 10,000, you're making what, 12.5 Bitcoin, like $125,000. If you're and you're running this thing at like half a watt, like, you know what I mean? It's just, for a lot of people, that's like, that's better than going out and buying scratch tickets. So I like that idea. I think it's a really cool like community. And I also get super nerdy with things like someone took an old IBM mainframe computer and it does like 6 hatches a second. Like it'll take like 3,000 years to like make a cent.
Definitely. Get a USB ASIC stick miner, Bitcoin lottery every 10 minutes. Roll the dice, baby.
Yeah, exactly. I'm all in favor of it. I think it's really cool. But GPU mining, I think part of the, and I don't want to ramble too much, but I think part of the reason that, you know, we've developed kind of the model that we do is because GPU mining is cool, but you can switch to any algorithm that's profitable. In fact, there's profit switching programs that you can do that. When you buy an ASIC, especially if it's not just like a Bitcoin ASIC, you have to kind of understand the token economics behind it. And also, that's a choice for so-called life. That's a choice for the life of that piece of hardware. you only get to make that decision once when you purchase it. If Bitcoin tanks, you're still left holding the bag with that ASIC. It's not like you can just switch it over to, you know, say Ethereum and go mine with it. And so part of the reason that we do what we do and our kind of investment thesis is we're going to try to understand all of the data points that go into that so you can make the best educated decision off the get-go, because you only get one chance to make it with ASICs. Yeah, so
definitely. Let's transition to a huge part of mining, and that is electricity prices. So
I was thinking the same thing, how are you gonna justify these prices? This is going to be interesting.
Yeah, because Josh is in Korea. You know, I'm in the U.S. I think you're in the U.S. So you the U.S. and Europe and a lot of parts of Asia have pretty high electricity prices. But other places, it's highly subsidized. It's free. Me and Josh have talked about this on the channel. So how do you compete with that? And even state to state, I think where I'm in, I'm outside Providence and Rhode Island has some of the highest electricity prices in the country versus, you know, some electricity prices out in the Pacific Northwest. They're half the price or less. So,
yeah. Aside from basically, I'll say this, there are pockets in the United States and this is for investor confidence. There's, I think, always going to be like, especially, Soviet bloc type, you know, like old infrastructure. Keep in mind that when you're mining on a huge level, these are millions and millions of watts, so megawatts, right? You know, you can get up to some of the largest mines we know about are 200 megawatts, which is an unfathomable amount of electricity. To give you like a rough idea, like say the town that I work in, which is kind of an average sized town, runs 50 megawatts. That's a day, so megawatt hours, right? That's for the entire town. So like when you look at some of these projects, they're massive, so you obviously need the lowest power rates. There's always going to be really cheap places, for example, like China on hydropower, where there's very little, they're running it right there, so there's very little transmission costs. They're, you know, during the wet and dry season, there's differences obviously, but you're gonna be oftentimes sub 3 cent electricity. But in terms of investor confidence, we focus mainly on North America. And so in North America, there are pockets where it's much, much less expensive. One of the main places is in Washington State. That's where Google and Amazon run most of their data centers as well. Niagara area, where we started originally. Buffalo because of Niagara Falls, and also zoning laws having to do with kind of like the way New York is structured, natural gas facilities in kind of the West. And there are places in the United States where you can achieve, sub 3 cents if you're really looking hard. But these are generally places in scale. Just to give you an idea how much it matters in crypto mining, like we're talking about the halving, which I'm not sure. Would you like me to explain a little bit?
Yeah, no, I think most of our listeners know, but he's talking about the Bitcoin halving. So it's at 12 and a half right now, I believe.
Yep.
So it'll go down to, I guess, 6.25. And yep, it'll exactly. continue to halving. So it's at 12 and a half right now. Before that, it was at 25. Before that, it was at 50. So it keeps halving and halving. So some people think it'll make the price go up. But if it doesn't, you're getting half the coins.
Exactly. And your OPEX, so what you pay for electricity and maintenance and all that, stays the same. So that's a kind of like a autonomous self-upgrading of the network, which is really fascinating that you get an entire network that upgrades basically autonomously based on economic pressures. But just to give you an idea, like the most common miner run right now, the S9, by most of our calculations is basically dead at anything under 4 cents, and probably not even really worth running at that price, based on just like rack size and how much more opportunity cost it would take to run a bunch of those. And that's due to the electrical efficiency of these chips and the process. So electricity price does matter a ton. What we try to do is balance, essentially we run a simulation where we balance two different variables, which is hash per watt and hash per dollar. So for example, it's all on a continuum. So hash per dollar is something like an S9 or a Dragonmint T1. These are all miners that are super cheap on the used market. And so you could get, you know, something that hashes pretty well for $200-something, say an S9, it's, you know, but that's going to be really electrically inefficient. So you really, really need a very, very low power rate, to make that worthwhile versus something, you know, in the middle, say like a T17 by Bitmain is a newer chip. It's a middle of the road chip. And that's a balance between basically, you know, that thing may cost $1,400, but that's a balance between basically the ultra low, which is the hash per dollar on one side and hash per watt on the other. And then you get to the super efficient stuff like the M20S or S17 Pro, where it's the most electrically efficient, but these things cost $3,000 a machine. So depending on your site and depending on, we do the whole thing. So depending on essentially where you want to go and what your CapEx is looking like, we actually pick a miner based on the site. Most firms that are going to advise in the space actually pick pick a miner before they pick the site. But we look at it as a holistic picture. But electricity price matters a ton. We, you know, right now, one of the more interesting projects we're working on is called Project Verde. And it is basically monetizing, and this is really where my head's at now. I believe everything trends towards zero, especially with renewables. So it's monetizing basically electrical capacity that the grid either won't purchase or won't transmit. And so getting it as close to zero as possible. So for example, you've got, you know, hydropower facilities in Brazil, that are running sub 1 cent electricity. And so we look at this as a continuum where we have client projects that are running, you know, we'll be running 5 cent, then, you know, 3 cent power. And then, you know, when those machines are done, they'll move over to there. So kind of having that runway of basically trying to squeeze the most amount of profitability out of all of them is really where our head's at. But I mean, you can run almost any machine on the planet indefinitely if you're sub 2 cents for the most part.
Yeah. I mean, we joked about it, but yeah, if you get free electricity in your dorm room or, you take over the utility closet and at your office space, just go YOLO.
Exactly. And people do that. Like I will say this, there have been studies where you trace back a lot of the GPU mining and like most of it is university students because it's great beer money, honestly.
Definitely. So, all right. Yeah. I want to get into Harpy, but I want to ask you one more general question first. So we've been talking a lot about proof of work mining, and there's other algorithms too. There's proof of stake, there's delegated proof of stake, there's hybrid proof of work, proof of stake. So I kind of want your thoughts on the future of proof of work coins in the crypto space. Because, you know, some people, Andreas Antonopoulos, he thinks that in the future, Bitcoin is going to be the only proof of work coin. It's not necessary to have more than one. Other people think it's the most efficient or it's the most secure. Yeah. And there's going to be a lot of them. Some people think most are going to go to proof of stake. Some people think most is going to go to hybrid models. So do you have any feeling or take on what kind of consensus algorithms are going to be popular in the future?
Sure. Yeah. To put it plainly, our business is based off proof of work. Not that we haven't looked at like masternodes or proof of stake, and that sort of thing. But fundamentally, when we like look at kind of what we've built over the last 2 years, it's pretty much exclusively on proof of work. And so I am biased when I say that I think proof of work is here to stay. I also think that it is fundamentally the reason that Bitcoin is valuable. I look at Bitcoin very simply, and this is, you know, up for discussion because everyone looks at it differently. But I look at it as basically the price of the computer amortized over the time period that computer runs, basically, and then times the electricity that it takes to run it, and that gives you one price, and that's your production price, and anything you can get higher than that. Say on the open market, that delta is basically where your money is. But for example, when you look at kind of 2018 and the crash, if you notice, it stays like at 3,500. Well, that's kind of that's the most efficient miner price. Like that is where the most efficient miners on the planet in our calculations are basically still a little bit profitable. So let's say they're mining at 3,200 or something, and they're selling it at 3,500. But that, so I always think the proof of work is going to be here. I think for, I agree to some extent with Andreas when he thinks that, you know, Bitcoin will be king. I think it largely has to do with the fact that Satoshi is nowhere to be found, because all these other, you know, proof of work coins, you still have either like a kind of a central power or a company behind it or a board behind it, right? So I think that
feeds in pretty well to the next question, actually, which is going to be about forks. So what are your opinions on, you know, the Bitcoin forks that have gone down, especially Bitcoin Cash, BSB, and the other forks? Could you just give your thoughts on the forks?
I'm pretty heavily into Bitcoin. I don't believe, like, for example, I get into fights on Twitter all the time with Bitcoin SB people. I think it's ridiculous. I understand, you know, but like, I understand some of their points, but fundamentally, like where's your Genesis block? Like any Bitcoin I have, I can trace it all the way back to, like the Chancellor on the verge of bailout. Like literally, actually, funny fact, my co-founder has that literally written on him. He has the Genesis block as a tattoo, which is pretty sweet. Trying to get, like, if you get really super nerdy with this, but I think that, like, when Bitmain and what's it called, like Bitmain with the whole BECH thing, where they're backing a lot of that, almost like that got Jihan Wu, who's their CEO, like out, like almost sunk it. I just think that it's a lot of people trying to manipulate the name and kind of the value behind Bitcoin for their own purposes. And I don't see it really adding to it. I'm very opposed to basically calling things Bitcoin that are not Bitcoin. And I think that kind of, yes, the, like anything else in the world, and this is obviously probably it's an opinion, like anything else in the world, there's always going to be change on a network, especially one that's based on basically miners' wishes. But I think that basically sticking to as close to kind of like Satoshi's original vision as possible is actually kind of a fallacy, because things are supposed to move and develop and change. In my opinion, it's like basically reading the Bible as gospel versus interpreting it. Don't think that white paper needs to be adhered to 100%. So I will say that about forks, like some of them, you know, there is some interesting ideas, and but fundamentally, I don't own anything else besides Bitcoin and ETH at the moment, and that's fundamentally because I just believe in the thing that has the most miner backing, and that would be Bitcoin at this
time. Okay,
so BTC.
That answers my question really quite comprehensively. That's good. So you really are holding just Bitcoin. You're only mining Bitcoin and Ethereum, and then sometimes you're mining some of the speculative coins that you think, you know, might increase in price, even if you're actually losing money in electricity. Is that right? Is that the three strategies?
Yeah. I mine Ethereum mainly. I don't mine Bitcoin per se for myself. We have clients that we've advised that do a whole bunch of other stuff. Obviously, it's always on a continuum. If you have a client that's very, that's risk adverse, you're always going to point them towards Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining. But it does have the most competition out of any network. So, you know, per dollar, there are other networks and other ASICs developed where you can make quite a bit more money. But the problem with that is also it's a higher risk, right? If that network gets 51% attacked, or, you know, or the developers decide to leave, or, you know, there's other things that shake it up, it's not going to be as resilient as like Bitcoin or Ethereum for that matter. And so, look, there's a whole bunch of people that are very into speculative coins, and that's good for them. As a company, we generally stick to advising on Bitcoin. That's what we find most clients are looking for. I will say this though about proof of stake. Yeah. I will say this about proof of stake, because I did gloss over the subject. Proof of stake is really cool, but I think fundamentally it's more interesting for internal applications. meaning that you have like a corporation or something or a supply chain where you don't, because fundamentally you don't need to essentially use all that power to confirm transactions or confirm things, you know, like data on the blockchain. And so for those internal purposes and enterprise level solutions, I think proof of stake is absolutely going to be a huge thing. Delegated proof of stake, like all of these different, even proof of storage in some cases, like I'm a huge Burst fan coin, even though I don't run it, so to speak. But like, those are things that yes, like will be built, but will be there. But for public blockchains, you know, where you don't know all the parties involved, I think proof of work is definitely here to stay. And so I'm very big on that. And I look at it. Yeah, that's nice. How I look at it.
So nice. Are you thinking about stuff like Facebook's Libra coin? That will be obviously something like a proof of stake, because it doesn't make sense for it to be proof of work. Things like, you know, Hedera Hashgraph, that's along those lines. All right, that makes sense. Well, you've also set us up really nicely to transition to talk about your business now, because I think, you know, Harpier Mining, what do you do for clients? So you've mentioned clients, you've alluded to a couple of things that you advise them on. What are the range of services that you do at Harpier?
Sure. So fundamentally, the reason for Harpier, what we primarily focused on for a long time, it's like any startup and like any business, it changes over time, but was to make that first purchase essentially the solid one. When we were in that original model that I alluded to, we had GPUs as well as ASICs in there. Now we primarily just do ASIC modeling, although there are things like composable compute and AI applications where some people may be wanting to run GPUs alongside for mining on the side or other purposes, which is a whole different ballgame. So fundamentally what we built and what kind of influences all of our decisions as a company is data sets and an ability to do consultancy and management for clients and fundamentally to advise on basically the first build out or a new hardware swap. And that's by running a ton of different data sets on things like difficulty, on things like as I talked about, hash per watt versus hash per dollar, on, you know, that sort of thing where we're basically trying, and it's mainly difficulty, trying to predict, well, what would this thing look like, not just in the next 6 months, and not linearly, but over the next 5 years, so that we can kind of reach a lot more of the larger financial institutions. And then eventually kind of bring that down to like a consumer level. So fundamentally what we do is consult and manage for Bitcoin projects. I like to say that we're a boutique mining solution, and we essentially now can take people from step A all the way through step Z. Essentially, if you have capital on one side, we can run the simulations, tell you what miner to put at what place in the country. We have a whole portfolio of all of those places, as well as, you know, kind of everyone on speed dial in terms of all the major manufacturers for all of these things, as well as the used market, and really take you through the steps and deploy. I mean, we've got industry leaders on our team. We've got, you know, someone who's done data centers for 25 years at a much greater level than just crypto mining. And so that's really where we're at right now in terms of what we provide our clients. But a day-to-day thing is a lot of proposals for clients that show this ASIC versus this one. What are you going to make in the next 3 to 5 years? Here's what difficulty is going to look like at the halving versus post-halving, and benchmarking things like asset price valuations against kind of like where a client would be. So saying at 8K Bitcoin, what kind of difficulty can you expect? Or, I mean, for layman's terms, what kind of competition can you expect? And thus, how much can you expect to make versus at 15K, right? At 15K, you can have home miners that are a lot more profitable, right? Whereas at 8K, you know, it's pretty much the institutions. And that changes kind of all of the economics behind it. So I guess I was pretty long-winded.
Typical customer avatar, yeah. so to speak, if you could you describe who would be your typical client, you know, like sure. in the marketing world, we like to say, oh, there's a customer avatar. We know what age they are. We know what gender they are. We know what they're into. If you could describe yeah. your perfect customer, what would it, you know, what would it look like?
Perfect customer. That's hard. Someone who is ready to move quickly and has the capital that they're that or is willing to put it in. We operate on two different levels. As I said, we're kind of consultancy and management for Bitcoin miners. So on one end, for example, we do things like pairing someone that has existing miners up with a hosting facility and kind of sitting in the middle there. And that's a really easy transaction for us. So that's one of those ones where it's super simple. It's kind of like two phone calls if the client is really serious. And so on one end, we're helping in a way, and we've moved away from this in a little bit, but helping hosters basically seal up clients that they may not otherwise get, by giving them the types of data sets that show kind of profitability and what your, I guess like, you know, what your costs will be over a long period of time. And on the other side, it's primarily yes. focused towards financial institutions and high net worth individuals. It's not really okay. where I want it to be, in the future. I really want to democratize this to the point where I can be in any country in the world and spend $10 and own a piece of infrastructure. That's kind of the dream here, and also run it all on renewable energy. But these are things that we work towards. But it's really most of my job fundamentally is actually dumbing down a lot of these terms and bringing this basically so that you have something that looks more like a financial document than anything else that you'd normally see, because we see a lot of enterprise level, you know, investments and solutions and financial, you know, kind of behemoths coming into the space. And so we're geared towards high net worth individuals and large clients like that.
All right.
On a large scale. Yeah.
Well, maybe let's break it down into three different segments then. Let's say first segment would be your average Joe the plumber, guy in the street, wants to sure. talk to you and say, look, I've got 20 grand. What do you recommend? And then you've got like, let's say a small size enterprise that is interested in getting in, they can throw maybe, let's say, $250,000 into this. And then you've got the large institutions where, you know, they can go 10 million plus, 5 million plus, whatever.
Yeah.
So how would you approach those three different clients?
So, yeah, it's a really good, and that falls under the continuum of kind of services, right? For something as small as, say, Joe the plumber, I would say most of it is basically advising on what particular machine would be best for them, and then bringing them. And we really don't do a whole lot in that realm, just because it's just not kind of in our ballpark yet. But that would be basically pointing them towards a hosting facility that we know that we trust. And maybe helping them at $20,000 get a slight discount on their machines. And so that's kind of where we put them. When you get to the, you know, $250,000 to $500,000, you're looking at potentially co-location. So instead of just basically paying somewhere in the six to eight cent range for your to host your miners all in, maybe now you're co-locating with another smaller miner and owning some of the transformers or infrastructure around it. And then when you get to the higher level, it's quite literally either developing, say, like a brownfield, or like developing an actual site for it, or purchasing an existing site, or going and saying, we're going to put mining pods, which are shipping containers converted to run miners out on an actual gas pipeline or under solar panels. Hopefully hydropower facility. So on the very high end, that's really like that's primary, but that's, you know, but there is something for everyone here. I would say our minimum though generally is like, in order to actually like move and start securing a lot of these lower power rates and good bulk discounts on miners, it's going to be in the 500,000 range and up.
Yeah, interesting. I had a question about what you alluded to earlier, kind of maybe touch on it again, the Project Verde. My Spanish isn't good. I think it means Project Green. And a lot of people yep. talk about how Bitcoin's destroying the environment, but I think a lot of people make the case that running miners with the renewable energy is actually a good thing. So I kind of want your take on that in general, and also kind of tell me a little bit more about Project Verde.
Yeah, absolutely. Project Verde is kind of my my favorite thing to do during the day. I mean, you know, we do it all, but in terms of kind of like where we are for the world, I really mentally think that blockchain and Bitcoin is awesome for the I also think that it's really amazing for democratizing value and ownership. In terms of like ever in history, I don't tie the products of my labor or my productive value to an institution or a government, which is, I think, really awesome and really why I love Bitcoin. And then finally, I think you can actually save the planet by using Bitcoin. And the basic idea is that there's a ton of wasted energy on the planet to the tune of like, you know, millions and millions and millions of megawatts. Essentially, by monetizing that, you can give that money back to renewable energy providers. So we look at Bitcoin, and I think I alluded to this a little bit, at least for Project Verde's purposes and kind of my thesis on Bitcoin in general, as an economic battery of sorts. And what that really means is that this is a way to store value and basically store the value of computational cycles. So rather than building out kind of very expensive, either lithium ion or there's obviously other battery storage techniques perfected by groups like Tesla or something, what you're actually doing is using composable demand. So bringing mining to a place where there's excess energy and using the predictable monetization off that. And that's really why we are so big on data, is the predictable monetization of that to then transform essentially the livelihood of that renewable energy provider. So let's say the grid won't buy 5 megawatts. Well, you can either put the storage in and then sell it back to the grid, or you can run miners whenever the grid curtails you, basically shuts you off because there's excess power or there's higher demand supply versus demand. And that's really like, you know, that's something that's really fascinating. So Project Verde is built on that idea of basically delivering mining pods anywhere on the planet that can basically utilize them to predictably monetize excess power. I love like Greta Thunberg and like all of the stuff that's going on in terms of the climate strikes and all that. But I'm of the opinion fundamentally that if there's no money behind it, it doesn't function. Like Shell and, you know, all BP and all the major polluters in the world are all, you know, ready to switch to renewable energy because you can trend towards zero. You're not piping it in. You're not doing, you know, there's less basically overall cost. But there needs to be a financial incentive. And so to give you an idea, like they spend billions of dollars basically in lobbying to keep fossil fuels around. The renewable energy providers spend almost nothing. I think in 2005 it was like $500,000 versus like, you know, multi-millions to keep their like way of life around. And what better way to basically take on some of these enormous, some of these enormous like powers that be than piggybacking on a $300+ billion public network to basically monetize. And so that's really where Project Verde is happening. We're trialing it out right now. We're basically finalizing talks with a bunch of Brazilian hydropower plants that actually have these transmission and curtailment issues and should be deploying within the next 6 to 8 months there. So that's a really exciting and large project.
That's awesome. Harpia Mining is going international. I think, I wanted to play devil's advocate, but I think you made a pretty good rebuttal there. Because, yeah, people say, like, look at how many megawatts are used to mine Bitcoin. Well, look at how many megawatts are wasted every day.
Yeah. I also want to just, like, point out that it's only because we can see this because it's a public network and we can kind of understand, essentially, like, okay, well, this many petahashes would be essentially this amount of electricity if you're looking at an average miner, that we understand the environmental impact of Bitcoin. People like to throw around these things like, oh, it takes more power than Iceland. Like if we then just take a step back and look at the hidden costs of the money we're spending it in transporting it in trucks the armored trucks, like in even just the massive servers that these banks run oftentimes in highly optimized areas. You're looking at something that to run our fiat systems, especially all over the world, that don't interface perfectly with each other. You're looking at something that's so much greater than that. The entire Bitcoin network pales in comparison to something like Amazon and Google, right? While still transmitting value all over the planet for a fraction of any other system. So I look at it and I say, like, running a lot of power is not necessarily a problem. It's where you get that power and how you can monetize it for the provider. And in doing so, I think it's better just to use as much power as possible, especially if they're already producing it. Because at one point, they have to make a decision between spending more to buy more solar panels so they can create more more energy and sell it, or spending, because it costs about the same amount to it, right? Spending that money on storage. And most of the time, they choose to build out more solar panels because there are more subsidies on that as well. And so what you look at is this problem of curtailment and wasted power going absolutely, absolutely crazy and only getting worse. The figure I like to use is that, I've talked about this before, in the spring, when this is at its worst, like 8,000 megawatts is curtailed in California on a daily basis. That's enough to power Boston. So it's not that we're not producing enough power, and it's not that renewables can't fundamentally, take over and make a greener grid. It's that our distribution is absolutely terrible, and it's antiquated. And by basically creating composable demand, you can solve that problem on the back of Bitcoin. And so that's where my passion truly lies.
So Josh, you want to jump in here?
Yeah, I was listening. I think it's pretty incredible, actually. Just to pose a thought experiment, if you could buy any piece of renewable energy land, so that may be a desert in Arizona somewhere, or a geothermal spot in Iceland, or maybe hydroelectric dam or something like that, where would you go for the best source of renewable energy for you to run your mining rigs?
Look, anytime you look at these things, you gotta think, okay, is it intermittent power or is it constant energy, right? And so hydropower plants, for the most part, while there are flow differences in season, which are actually coincidentally reflected on the Bitcoin price, and I have a thesis about that, wet versus dry season in China and how it affects Bitcoin, but without getting too far into it, if I had to choose anything, I'd probably choose geothermal, and I'd probably choose Iceland. Although right now the political climate may not be the best for it there, but it's because it's constant power and there's no flow changes for the most part. The next step would be, or the next one would totally be hydro, and then probably wind or solar is a close second. I like solar. I think it's cool. So, but offshore wind would be
okay.
Yeah,
that's cool.
You want something that's constant,
I don't
want to
cut you short. Let's go into that China dry and wet, the dry season, the wet season in China. I think that's an interesting topic to discuss. Do you mind expanding on that a little bit?
Yeah, not at all. There are differences in terms of like essentially how much water is running through turbines in the major production, like the major Bitcoin mining centers in China. Unlike the United States, like for example, Boston, where you have a housing problem, China kind of like moves in the way, like you're going to, like Kohl's or Macy's or something and buying like all the shoes for your children before they grow up into them on deep discount. So they'll build like entire cities and then move population centers to them and give incentives for businesses to go there. But there's a lot of what we call ghost cities there, which are essentially like cities where it's already built out. And some of these experiments have worked really well. Like Shenzhen used to be a fishing village, and now it's the major manufacturing hub of the world. But other cities are basically out there, like in Inner Mongolia, right? And you've got so much power to power a city, and no one using it. So these have been one of the common misconceptions about China is that a lot of Bitcoin is actually mined on coal. Yes, that is true to some extent, but a lot more is actually mined on renewables and actually hydro. with these ghost cities where the infrastructure and the transformation of the power is already there, and all you have to do is kind of, you know, build out your mining farm. The issue is that at some points, the flow rate basically through these turbines is much lower. So I might not have the dates or months correct, but I think it's like March through December is wet season, and then everything else is essentially dry season. And so during the wet season, since there's more rain coming down, it's going to, you know, you have way more, basically more turbines spinning, so to speak, and you've got lower power costs, which means you can turn on more miners that would be, as we talked about price fluctuations, or I mean, electricity costs, you can turn on more miners that would be on before. And this is also where you can turn on older stuff as well. You see, I think, pretty noticeable hash rate jumps, at least in the past, from wet season to dry season. And I think it also impacts difficulty. And so, you know, but also you've got to think about these people needing to pay their operational costs, meaning that most miners will mine for profit, but they'll use some of the Bitcoin, sell it off, and then use that to basically pay their operational costs. And so a lot of them are trading on OTC or over the counter desks, right? So they don't affect Bitcoin price as much, but you see basically more Bitcoin available for sale versus people hodling it because they're running just more machines and have to pay for more OPEX. And so I haven't proven this out. I'm pretty busy on a day-to-day basis, but I have this thesis that essentially that during the wet season, by selling more Bitcoin and increasing volume, that the price should go up. And so if I had more time, or if I could clone myself, I would totally just spend like 3 months doing that study and then publishing it or something like that. But that's kind of where my head's at about that.
That's interesting. That's really interesting. And you mentioned OTC. So over the counter, just for people that are listening and might not know what that is, that's where you're not going on an exchange. You're not using an exchange to trade between people. You're basically going direct to the person that you're buying from or selling to. And do you actually have connections with OTC desks? And can you expand on that a little bit more? That's an interesting topic to get into.
Sure. I mean, it's not something we've utilized thus far, but we do have connections to OTC desks and banks that can trade. Kind of like, you know, you'll sell a bank account, so to speak, with a bunch of Bitcoin inside, which is another way to transfer. But OTC desks are interesting also because there is, with kind of incoming regulation, there's this idea of like virgin coins, or I don't know if that's the proper term for it, but essentially coins that have just been mined, achieving a higher valuation than coins that have been passed around. Because it's kind of like, because the government basically says, and this is the US government basically says, yeah, we'll be tracking the transactions. And so if you don't want to have that happen, it's kind of like a ghost gun, right? You can go buy a gun in a store, but if you commit a murder with it, then they can trace it back to you. Well, if you go buy a gun with no serial number or whatever it's called, you know, identification on it, then you can commit a murder and it won't be traced back to you. Similar thing. That by trying to add more regulation and kind of scrutiny to the Bitcoin network, you're actually kind of backfiring on you, because these virgin coins will be worth more. And so in terms of, if that does happen, we'll be dealing with a lot more OTC desks, because there'll be higher demand for mined coins to the tune of, some people have said, like 30% higher markup on those coins, which is nuts. But not something we do on a normal basis, though we do have the connections. Crypto is really small, especially the mining community. There's like probably 120, 150 people that are like really doing it. And then, you know, there's a bunch of people that cycle out every couple of years, especially when there's bear markets and stuff and people shut down their mines. And there's a lot of companies now that are starting kind of like what we do, is providing services to miners and not straight up mining themselves. Although, you know, our end goal is to be really mining for ourselves as well. So.
Well, you mentioned about, you know, incoming regulations and legislation and more oversight from the government, things of that nature. So what are your thoughts on the privacy coins that are out there? So you've got your PIVX, you've got your Dash, you've got your Zcash, yeah. You've got your Zcoin, and you've got your Monero. What are your thoughts on those types of coins?
Uh, I'm interested in the privacy aspect to a great deal. I think that I think as I kind of said before, it's really important for people to have a way to store their value without tying their labor to basically their government. And this is kind of the first time in history where you can do that. To some extent, you can do that with gold, but it's very hard to, you know, transfer a bunch of gold, and you can't really like walk across a border with it. And so I look at this and I'm like, fundamentally, I think we have to pay respects to kind of the cypherpunks and the people that really designed all this, and kind of implemented it and had this idea of the ability to transfer privately and not be watched and on everything you do and, you know, own value and be able to transfer that peer to peer. And so I'm really in favor of privacy coins. My favorite story is the kind of the founder, or I guess the guy who created Monero. They asked him like, well, where's all your Monero? He's like, yeah, I had the private key written on a piece of paper and I was on a cruise and it just like slipped out of my hand. And so I don't own any more Monero anymore. And it's just kind of like pointing fun at them, like, try me, you know what I mean? Like you can't figure it out. Even if I did have $1 billion of Monero, like you won't be able to find it anyway. So like, kind of, you know, like get out of here. I might be a little bit of a kind of a crypto anarchist or something when I say that, like, I absolutely love privacy coins, and I understand there's a dark underbelly to it. And, you know, and with anything, there's a lot of corruption in mining. There's a lot of scammers in crypto. But I like, especially like Monero, you know, Zcoin, like all those things, I'm a huge fan of it. I say resist and resist and resist until, you know, they kind of give in because they can't control it, you know, the powers that be. So
yeah, I'm a big fan of privacy coins too. I was at one of my local crypto meetups and someone gave me some Beam, and that's a pretty interesting project as well. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm a big fan of crypto, private cryptocurrency for sure. Immutable, unfungible,
one thing that's really impressive is, you know, Zcoin have managed to actually get on Prompt Pay. So Prompt Pay is a payment network with the banks in Thailand. I'm very surprised at that, because now you can essentially live in Thailand completely anonymously, paying only with Zcoin, and Prompt Pay is in 5 million different locations throughout Thailand.
Are you serious? That's incredible.
I'm serious. It's absolutely incredible. So I couldn't believe it at first when I heard about it from the Zcoin guys. And then I looked into it, and there's a short documentary where a guy went out for about 3 weeks and just lived exclusively on Zcoin. And you can buy it at local, you can spend it at local markets, because what Prompt Pay is essentially like a QR code that's hooked up to the banking system in Thailand. And I don't know how they managed to pull it off. They probably met the right guy and did the right deal at the right Noribang or whatever. And now you can basically live off the grid in Thailand if you've got enough Zcoin. I thought it was incredible. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. Just to wrap this up, because we've covered so much today, I think it's been an awesome interview, honestly. You've got a depth of knowledge which is clear. So it's been a fantastic podcast episode. We're going to clip this up into lots of different clips, because you've covered a lot. But there's something we do at the end, which is just for fun.
I got one more question before that, though. Real quick, though, if you could, Jesse, what is the biggest adoption, biggest obstacle to mass adoption, in your view, to adopting crypto? Why is it still such a niche and no one knows about it, no one uses it, no one buys it, no one hodls it?
I think it's, first off, I think that the number one thing that I've always had to deal with is people are like, I can't afford a Bitcoin. And I'm like, that's great, but you can afford a couple of cents of Bitcoin. So when people say that to me, I always transfer them Bitcoin. And I think that ownership, like if there was some way, there used to be Bitcoin faucets, and they were a lot more popular than they are now. But back when Bitcoin was worthless, you had people tipping each other in it. You had people that were kind of giving it out on forums that were doing things with it. And I think in many ways, while I am deeply involved in the idea of hodling, and I believe it will go, you know, exponential. And in many ways, I'm hoping, you know, I'm betting a lot of my productive life on it. I think just using Bitcoin is a lot more, is a lot more meaningful. And I think that's the main like pain point in adoption. So whenever someone says basically like, well, I can't afford Bitcoin, well, I can't do this, I tell them download Jax or, you know, another wallet on your phone and I will send you it in real time. And it makes it real for them. My co-founder, Pedro, CEO of the company, he actually like, this is a very interesting thing because he lives halfway in Brazil, halfway in the United States. And so he keeps most of his wealth similar to, you know, some of like the big guys in crypto in Bitcoin. I would say probably 95% of his wealth is in Bitcoin. And the reason is because he can transfer out to reais in Brazil and he can transfer to US dollars here. And using like BitPay and stuff like that, you can like, we'll literally be at a crypto conference and he will purchase the Uber by like using Bitcoin. There's one step in between, but eventually there won't be that step. But just using, it goes against like the whole idea of like hodling and right. And like, this is a store of value, but just using crypto, I think makes it so much more real to people that you can purchase things that you can, you know, transfer information, like when it comes to the Ethereum network. And really that idea that I can't afford it, it's, or it's like, it's too foreign. I'm like, this is very similarly to Venmo. So if I had like any one thing that I would like love to do, I would love to do something like QR codes, mom and pop, like literally place a sticker on that and you can just pay using crypto, or like Venmo with Bitcoin, right? That's like that, bringing it to more people. I think that's the hardest thing to just get over that initial hump. Like, oh, it's foreign and I can't own it. People start using, like, understand it.
Yeah, definitely. It's like, oh, I can't afford a, you know, 100-pound bar of gold. Well, you can probably afford a gold coin. You know, it's
exactly
Bitcoin's divisible for sure. All right, Josh, you want to hit him with our last question?
Well, I was just going to expand on that now we've gone there. So I often send bits of Bitcoin to my cousins and stuff when it's their birthday because they don't know anything about it. I'm like, just generate an address and I'll send you some Bitcoin. So we've got some cousins up in Scotland, and whenever they hit a birthday, I send them like a little bit of Bitcoin. A couple of years ago, I sent them 0.1 Bitcoin when it was like maybe $500. So that was good. He definitely remembers that. And I think it's always good to share the wealth and the knowledge, because once people have got it, they get it. You know, that something clicks in their head and they really understand it. There's something about actually
appreciating it.
Yeah, receiving it and being able to understand it and use it, then it's, you know, that's the paradigm shift that people have. So just to wrap it up, normally we do something fun, and it's just the price prediction for Bitcoin in the next year by 2020. We've talked about the halving coming in. So personally, I'm quite bullish about price in the next year. I think that I called a high of 86 and a low of 6 in 2020. What are your thoughts on the price?
So I guess I'll start I am a huge Tim Draper fan. I went through Draper University, so I know him personally. Awesome visionary guy. He's totally wacky. It's awesome to be around him. And he predicted if 5% of the world's wealth goes into Bitcoin, that's $250,000 a coin. And so I look at that and I'm like, that is very, very possible, especially with like the rise of authoritarian governments and kind of like for example, like Venezuela is like pretty much run on Bitcoin now. But so that's like the high end in the next couple of years. In terms of 2020, I'm a little bit more bearish than you. I'm thinking like high of 47 and probably low of 5,500. I don't think it's going to go much below that. I think that's the shutoff point once the halving comes for a lot of miners. So I don't see it going anywhere there. But I remember the run up in 2017, 2018, when like everyone and their grandma was buying Bitcoin, and when it shot up to, you know, 20,000. And I remember basically like the run from around 11 or 12,000 all the way to 20, where I started, you know, I had made a serious amount of profit. I started selling off at 10 because I was like, there's no freaking way it's going to go higher than this. Then it was like 12 the next day. And then like that day it went to 15. And I look at a run like that and I'm like, you know, there are specific price points that once we break, for example, like 9,600, I'm no trader, but like, you know, these are mental points. Like 10,000 is a huge mental point. 12,000 is a huge mental point. I see a run if we get anywhere in the 20 range, all the way up to 40 something. So I think what I said was, 47. and 55 is low.
Sweet. That's nice. It's good to hear that you share some bullish sentiment, maybe not as bullish as myself, but you know, we predicted a very similar low, which is interesting because yours is actually based on the cost to produce Bitcoin, you know, so that's really interesting. Yeah. I've got to say, thanks. Yeah. It's been a great episode, really. We've covered so much. So I'm going to look forward to reviewing this and going back and cutting this up into segments. Honestly, it's going to be great.
Nice. And Jesse, we'll give you the last word. Do you have anything else you want to say today to close it out?
First off, awesome job here too, you guys. Crypto is built on people's participation. Like, that's really the vision of this, is that, you know, you're not just working for some bigger entity. You're participating. That's what miners are. They're participants on a network. And so by doing stuff like this and bringing this out to a larger audience, you're basically like, we're all Satoshi in that way. You're doing your part to basically bring this out and educate people, which is, I think, fundamentally the most important thing we can do in cryptocurrency right now. A huge percentage of my day-to-day with my teammates, I guess team members, I'll shout out Pedro, our CEO, Zach, our junior analyst, Alex, our resident, like, Yoda guru, data center expert, you know, like what we do fundamentally is a lot of education and then putting all the pieces together. But by doing podcasts like this and starting here, you guys are like really doing your part. So thank you for having me. Awesome to be here. And I hope that more people start looking at crypto as a way to, like, I think this is like the last thing I want to say is that is looking at it as a way to separate from kind of the way our governments, especially in the United States, is kind of treating. Like, I'm not trying to get too political, but if we have any inkling that maybe their intentions are not in our best, or I guess I should say that's like, if we have any inkling that maybe our best intentions are not being met, it's so important to have this alternative. It's why it was created in 2000, you know, after 2008, to have this alternative to store value. And it's really important to educate about that and make sure that people understand that there's another option. And so we're all doing our part here. But I really hope that this podcast completely blows up and you guys are hitting a huge audience here, and I'm very happy to be a part of it. So thank you so much.
All right. Awesome. Well, that'll wrap it up for this episode. And until next time, this is it. And you can find Blockade, Hodling, and FPGA mining on the dark side of the HODL moon. Thank you for joining us on Dark Side of the HODL Moon. If you haven't already subscribed, please do so. Also, be sure to join our Telegram group, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, and follow us on BitChute and YouTube, where you can find all the episodes as well as highlights from previous episodes. You can also visit us at darksideofthehodlmoon.com.
HODL Moon!